Well, yes, and thank you to Stephen for having agreed to change, or more correctly, the organisers should thank Stephen for agreeing to change, because otherwise we would be a talk short. The title is TBA because I was rather hesitant about what to talk about, and because, you know, I was busy with some kind of obscure problem about excellent rings that I don't really think people would necessarily be interested in. But on the other hand, the all these various panel discussions kind of gave me an idea for what I would talk about, because these panel discussions, I made it something of a hobby horse about various logical obstructions about how you can, what you can, and what logically what are the possible strategies of proofs and kind of hyperbolicity type theorems. So therefore, at which point we can indeed announce the title. So I've decided that an appropriate title, in light of these panel discussions about logical obstructions, would be "There's No Shame in Total Failure." So, that's the title for the talk. So that's now been announced. So that's one thing less to do. So, so by its nature, I mean, if we're talking about such logical matter, the way that I came to reach these conclusions was actually via something that some reasonably old piece of work, even though its publication is relatively recent, just a few months ago, classification theory of foliated surfaces. Now, the object of this theory was that, basically the motivation of this theory was to kind of understand my own theorem. So the theorem in question was the following. So now we want to keep some things on the board. So which boards stay and which boards don't? This one stays. We could move that one up there. Okay, so, yes. So, and then how, yeah. Let me see if I can try and keep everything on one board. So the theorem was this. It was let X to XF be a foliated surface. And I'll define this word later with canonical singularities. And as I say, we'll come to possibly an actual definition later, and if for the moment you want to kind of imagine a definition, it is just the obvious functorial extension of the normal definition of canonical to the foliated context with canonical singularities, such that, well, the foliation has a canonical bundle and the space has a canonical bundle, and we'll maybe come to define these later, such that these two bundles between them, the cone generated by them, contains a big divisor, then any F from C to X invariant by F is algebraically degenerate. Okay, So, for example, I mean, this implied the hyperbolicity of surfaces with C1 squared bigger than C2 and things like this. But now, more importantly, the theorem is a reasonably straightforward consequence of the Hodge index theorem in the following three lemmas. So let me try and make the lemmas as brief as possible. One. Now, when you have some object like this, f from C to x, and in many ways this has certainly been more or less implicitly talked about and fairly explicitly talked about at various points during the conference, you can associate some closed 1-1 current to C by just looking at limits and exhaustions and so forth. And because it's invariant by a foliation, you can actually think of C in some appropriate limiting sense as a transverse invariant measure. So I'll write, instead of a current, I'll write that for transverse invariant measure, since categorically speaking, with respect to appropriate definitions, it really does satisfy a descent datum. So canonical singularities of the foliation functorially with respect to the ideals, and we'll discuss it more later. Okay? So lemma one is that with these hypotheses, kappa f dot p mu was less than or equal to zero. So this is some sort of generalization of, call it what you will, as Paul talked about, the so-called tautological inequality that's been mentioned a few times, or the lemma of the logarithmic derivative or whatever, but it is properly speaking a generalization of this fact that absolutely depends on having the right singularities and is essentially equivalent to it. Lemma two, which was essentially a theorem of Miyoka in dimension two, without loss of generality, we have a minimal model. Without loss of generality, K of F is an F. So basically, some sort of minimal model theorem along with foliation. And lemma three, which is the really tricky one, lemma three was the following, that if you took the first Chern class of the thing on the base, which you can be fancy about it and write it in stack notation if you like, but it's just some obvious subsheaf of the cotangent sheaf, dot d mu was non-zero, then that implied that the long numbers at the singular locus of d mu were non-zero. Now, right. Also, this is going to stay in the blog, so. Sort of. Okay, so it's exercise for the reader to deduce the theorem from the three lemmas, but for surfaces you can basically repeatedly use the Hodge index theorem. Now, in terms of my personal hobby horse about the things which are logically possible and not logically possible, and what's a first order statement and what's not a first order statement, lemma one is basically a first order statement in the sense that I'm kind of, all logical assertions will be modulo assuming something like the lemma of the logarithmic derivative or something like. So lemma one is basically first order assuming something like the Lentheria principle. So Lentheria principle will put in a logical world. Lemma two is basically a first order statement as well. Lemma three quite definitely is not. And lemma three was quite hard, so I wanted to kind of try to get rid of lemma three. Now, and I failed miserably. Now, So this classification theory, so let's kind of think, what was the proposed object of the relation between classification theory and this theorem, and then we kind of get to why we had a total failure. Now, classification theory, you shouldn't kind of take too much intuition from the case of the canonical bundle. I mean, this case of the canonical bundle, K of X, so, and for a start, you shouldn't think of K of X. You should think of K of X to a point. So, I mean, in standard categorical world, I mean, you know, you shouldn't think of objects, you should think of morphisms. So we should think of K of X to a point, and many of the things that you think of about K of X to a point are not actually functorial theorems. So somehow, what does functorial kind of theorem mean? Functorial theorem means that we define some two category, which contains some one categories, and the one categories are basically built up by gluing analytic opens such that curvature continues to make sense. So, for example, you see here I've written X modulo F, right? I mean, this really is a foliation. So, a perfectly good gentleman to put in one of these one categories would actually be the classifying stack of a foliation, and then you can take maps between these things and stuff like that. But I mean, you can make really, really complicated. I mean, just imagine the thing as complicated as you possibly could. So when you imagine it as complicated as you possibly could, various assertions are no longer true. So for example, finite generation of a canonical ring of things of general type is in general false. Is false in the proper categorical sense. So, I mean, if I go over here and maybe start introducing some definitions, this foliation here, we could write it as basically we're on a surface, so we just have some sequence of line bundles, although we've got some ideal of singularities here in the quotient, and we've kind of got some sub-bundle like this, which is actually canonically and functorially the pullback of a bundle on the classifying stack. And it transpires, for example, that you can perfectly well have KF being NF and big, but the associated canonical ring is not finitely generated. And this is already true. I mean, this example occurs in surfaces, but it's already true if you take MG1 over MG, which is a perfectly good foliation, rather simple one, but perfectly good. So the relative canonical bundle here, in this very algebraic setup, is not is nef and big, etc., but it's not. This is not generated by sections. For G bigger than or equal to 3. So there are many, many, many things in basically classification theory, the study of canonical bundle and so forth, which are in fact very, very, very special properties, which result from the fact of being over a point, and being over a point essentially allows us to, I mean, for example, what intervenes is vanishing. Now, so, this said, when you want to talk about general type objects in a very kind of broad context, it actually becomes the case, and not unrelated to the previous talk, is that the correct description is metrical. Correct description of general type is metrical. Correct meaning functorially correct, in the sense that, you know, I make as big a category as I like, and I want to put in lots of arrows and make things like really nasty and so forth. And this finite generation property is not preserved, but a metrical description is preserved. Now, the reason why a metrical description is preserved is the fairly remarkable properties, well, a posteriori, certainly somewhat remarkable, of kind of canonical singularities. And again, this could be stated in a very, very broad context. So a priori, you see, basically, what you do with canonical singularities in kind of the standard context, you're asking for the largest category, and usually you're working birationally, or it would appear you were working birationally. You would ask for the largest category, including smooth objects, such that when you had a map of any two things, that the ramification was bigger than or equal to zero. And normally here we are working with y being a birational model of x, y being a birational modification of x. However, once you actually put the definition like that, then there's no particular reason that you should actually keep restricting yourself to birational. And obviously, just again to fix ideas, so this would be the standard case, and for example, the foliated case, you could again look at a birational situation, a priori birational, and you would ask that the canonical bundle on G was bigger than or equal to the canonical bundle on F, and this would be the leafwise ramification. So as long as you keep in mind the picture that what you shouldn't really be studying is X, but rather morphisms, then this foliated definition is the a priori generalization of the usual definition. But as I say, there's absolutely no reason you should restrict it by rational. And it's a fairly amusing fact, and perfectly accurate, that once you're given that, if this is actually true birationally, then basically it implies that more or less all the time, implies that you still have ramification bigger than or equal to zero. Maybe you might have to exclude some kind of close the risky set or something like this, but not just for things which are dominant, but even for things which are actually not even equidimensional, which in the case of the foliation, I would take X mapping to X modulo F, and I would take F C going to a point of the classifying space, going to a point of the classifying stack, and then I assert that this assertion about canonical singularities is actually true if I choose this to be Y, which at least for F Sarisky dense is perfectly accurate, and that is the content of lemma 1. So this is a very, very, very general statement. So unlike something like the finite generations, it's something that holds, I mean, there's only so much generality in which I've so far checked it, but I've checked it in a lot of generality, and it seems to be an absolutely, well, completely general fact. I would be extremely surprised if there was any count, well, in fact, yeah, I would be astonished if there was any counterexamples, that this principle that this principle of having canonical singularities birationally, in the sense of the ramification being positive birationally or non-negative birationally, a priori, when you define canonical singularities, you say, let Y be a modification of X, and you suppose that the canonical divisor goes up. So what you're saying is that for an arrow, such that the arrow is is birational, you're saying that for birational maps, the ramification is bigger than or equal to zero. So for example, you can easily check that in the case of the standard theory of algebraic varieties, that once this is true for all birational arrows, it's actually true for all dominant arrows. So this is why, in particular, what this says is that it also says that this is also exactly the conditions under which the canonical bundle, or any canonical bundle of any description, I mean, whether it be here or anywhere else, should actually measure curvature. Because, again, here I've put the complex line perhaps to fix ideas, but in reality it would have been much better to put a disk which was invariant by the foliation, and then the definition of ramification being bigger than or equal to zero would just have been that the isoparametric inequality for the calculation of the area, not actually the area per se, but the integral of the Chern class of this K of F, was bounded by the length of the boundary. So canonical singularities are basically the same thing as saying, so another way of interpreting canonical singularities is that canonical bundle measures curvature. And again, this is in fact if and only if, I mean, which is perfectly straightforward to see, because I mean, you take a plane curve with a node, in fact you take a plane curve with several, you take some rational curve in P2 with lots of nodes, then the canonical bundle or the dualizing sheaf will be OD for D as big as I like, depending on how many nodes I put in the picture. But I can easily make this to be a rational curve with lots of nodes, so the canonical bundle does not measure curvature, because, you know, a rational curve with lots of nodes is really not very negatively curved. It just happens to have lots of nodes. So if your singularities are bad, the canonical bundle does not encode curvature. Now, so this said, the correct description of the situation is metrical, and from the point of view of wanting to understand the theorem in lemma 1, so lemma 1, highly categorical statement, true in a lot of generality, and lemma 1 evidently implies the theorem if K of F is big. Well, more or less, evidently. Agreed? Because, I mean, you know, this DMU, if I set it up properly, I mean, he will also, if the thing is not algebraically degenerate, DMU will actually be an F class, so this would be certainly impossible by the Hodge index theorem. So lemma 1 implies the theorem of K of F is big. So the plan of classification theory, so that the plan, or perhaps the non-plan might have been a better word, was why don't we just classify everything else? I mean, after all, classifying things, it's bound to be a first order statement, surely. So, no. So in dimension two, we're working in dimension two here to fix ideas. In dimension two, it was basically a theorem of Miyoka with a little bit of mild adjustment. It was a little bit theorem of Miyoka that either K of F is an F after some blowing down, or X to F, XF is a pencil of rational curves. Okay, so I think we can all agree that pencil of rational curves is a pretty good case, and not likely to intervene if we're studying surfaces of general type or some such thing. Miyoka did. Miyoka did bend and break along foliation. The general argument for doing it in all dimensions by Bogomolov and myself is a little bit different. But nevertheless, the important principle is indeed that this is somewhat more like Mori theory is the way Mori intended, with lots of rational curves and very little vanishing. In fact, vanishing here in the foliated context is not actually true. On the other hand, rational curve technology and bend and break does actually continue to be true. So in terms of my kind of nice categorical properties, rational curves as an obstruction to negative curvature, or the presence of rational curves when one doesn't have the right properties of line bundles as desired, should definitely be included as a general categorical principle. Now, okay, so we're off to classify everything else, and that was all going really, really well, and so remember now we can assume that K of F is an F. So provided the Quadira dimension of F is bigger than or equal to zero, then abundant folds i.e. U of KF equals kappa of KF. And also, I mean, as one might expect, I mean, the proofs are very similar to kind of standard proofs in Enriquez Castelnuovo Quadira classification. And you get some nice list. I mean, things of Quadira dimension zero are given by vector fields. Then you kind of, for Quadira dimension one, you kind of get suspensions of representations and elliptic fiber spaces and so forth. So that's all going really well, except that we came across the following obstruction. There exist examples. Sorry? This one? Yeah, I know. But I've run out of board. There exist examples such that numerical Quadira dimension is 1, and the actual Quadira dimension is minus infinity. Okay, so does anybody know any such examples? Come on, I mean, honestly. So, the obvious such example is to actually take a bidisk quotient. Bidisk quotient which is not a product of curves. So, such things certainly exist, and they have exactly this property. And the reason they have this property would be that if this were actually non-negative, one could actually check that that the thing is a product of curves. Now, on the other hand, you shouldn't be. I mean, if somehow that was the And of course, a bidisk quotient need not necessarily be smooth. So, idem for non-smooth bidisk quotients. Non-smooth quotients after resolving singularities. So, as it happens, there is actually quite a lot of similarity between. So, at the end of the day, this was a theorem, so that it became a theorem that these were the only counterexamples, namely the only things which were not of general type and which did not satisfy abundance were bidisk quotients. However, and this is where we arrive to a position of total failure, remember the object of the entire classification exercise was to essentially try to reduce the thing to a first order statement, and at the very worst, simply avoid any appeal to the transverse dynamics of the foliation. However, and the obvious plan for tackling something, for tackling some problem like this, was indeed to proceed with, by the study of Monge-Ampère foliations, namely, to try to put some semi-positive metric on this canonical bundle, and since the square of this bundle was zero, at least algebraically, to try to conclude that the kernel was a Monge-Ampère holomorphic foliation, and this would lead to the bidisk structure. Now, as it happens, using the kind of Bochner technique, you can actually prove the transverse holomorphicity if there existed a, say, something like, at the very least, and this, maybe not, looking at the CHERN class L2, even that, I mean, you needed a lot of a priori regularity on the metric to make it work. Now, this was a bit, well, this wasn't good. So at this point, and again related to the previous talk, Marco Brunella said, well, as it happens, one knows by virtue of the whole classification business that in this bad case, so the bad case where uk of f is 1 Pythagoras minus infinity, one knew that k of x dot k of f was actually positive, which, as it happens, implies that this cone contains a big. So Marco Brunello said, well, why don't we just actually apply the theorem so that we can use the Poincaré metric. We can actually take along each leaf the canonical metric given by the uniformization theorem, and let's try this gadget here. So this is Poincaré. So metric on along the leaves in the leafwise direction coming from the uniformization theorem. So exactly as in Tsuji's talk, the thing that had to be proved even before you could actually think about starting was that the transverse variation was plurisubharmonic. So at that point one wasn't quite done. I finished off by kind of strengthen the theorem to this theorem here to disk convergence. Now, again, all very relevant to the previous talk and also relevant to other previous work of Duval that I talked about yesterday. So in light of recent theorem of Duval, this last step can be regarded as superfluous. The statement about the Poincaré metric, at least in the presence of mirror morphicity, is a very, very soft statement, which again is true in a lot of generality. It fits in very well with the general categorical picture. We already saw an example in the previous talk. This is very much a general kind of property that one expects to hold. So this is a good soft property and true in a lot of generality. It's a good soft property and reasonably easily proved, actually, in the presence of mirror morphicity, even in the foliation context. So that one actually sees that in order to actually produce the correct metricization which allowed the Bochner technique to be applied and to deduce that the actual Monge-Ampère foliation was transversely holomorphic, the thing that was actually important was actually the theorem. So now we had got into a completely circular argument because we were trying to reprove the theorem by way of a much more algebraic proof. And then we can't do the algebraic proof, and since we can't do the algebraic proof, in order to finish the algebra we were trying to do, we appeal to the theorem. Now, this is, as I say, total failure. Now, so, I mean, you might get a nice classification theorem, but definitely there can be no doubt that it was a complete failure. So, now, I mean, as an application of the theorem, it's quite a good corollary, but in terms of an attempt to reprove the theorem, it was a bit of a disaster. Now, so therefore I think what I'll do in the last kind of 10 or 15 minutes is kind of just to describe in a little more detail the actual kind of properties that actually occur on these bidisk quotients, kind of what you can expect in their jet spaces or not expect in their jet spaces, and why they do actually pose a genuine logical obstruction as to how you actually might prove various hyperbolicity theorems. So the situation is this: let's take an algebraic surface which is a bidisk quotient. But, of course, there may actually be some cusps and so forth. So let's say S is the Bailey-Borel compactification. How do you spell Bailey? 1L3. Okay, that may be the wrong spelling. Bailey-Borel compactification. And... So The worst, I mean, the Bailey Burrell compactification could have some quotient singularities, which are already problematic, but let's just concentrate on the cusps. So a cusp will resolve to some polygonal arrangement of rational curves like this, so some cycle of rational curves, which let's call it Z. So, as I say, I'll ignore quotient singularities for simplicity. So, if I'm ignoring quotient singularities, I get some splitting of the cotangent bundle by a pair of holomorphic foliations which correspond to the two foliations on the bidisc. Now, and I'd like in particular to concentrate on the singular case, just to note some properties of it. So as we've seen, both of these bundles are left, and neither of these bundles have Quadira dimension. Now, suppose you take some jet space, sort of projectivized sort of Desmahiers jets, Desmahiers simple Arundel Sole Spicer invariant jets. You take some jets, then obviously at every point you've got a curve, you can differentiate the curve k times, and so you'll get some surface which is simply the systematic derivatives in the leaf directions, which will be a birational modification of S. And these jet spaces have various canonical bundles. I really don't care which ones you use. Any kind of twisted direct sum of these tautological bundles that appear in jet spaces, it doesn't really matter how you do it, just as long as they're all kind of not the negative sense. Then, no matter which tautological bundle you choose, if I take my Hilbert modular surface to have cusps, so in presence of cusps, this bundle here is never pseudo-effective for all k. And now, this is a rather curious fact, because related to something which came up yesterday, one can actually find more or less the opposite situation in positive characteristic. So in positive characteristic, let's say for simplicity, that this group gamma was SL2O of real quadratic ring of integers. So therefore, I get two mappings, X and Galois conjugation, into SL2R, two copies. So there's my action. And what happens is that, so I've got two different sorts of primes. I've got primes P such that splits and all. P splits and all. Now, P splits and all is the good case. So good means that basically the situation is more or less exactly as you would expect in characteristic zero. You've kind of even got some p-adic uniformization. The whole thing is really extremely hyperbolic. And you've got the bad case. So the bad case is P remains prime. Now, so in the bad case, A, there are rational curves on S modulo P of degree more or less around P. Now, in particular, this fact, which I didn't actually know at the time, actually implied that it was impossible to prove the theorem by first order logic. Because if you can do it by first order logic, then you can prove that the thing is hyperbolic, for that there are no rational curves for P sufficiently large. And this is a false statement. Now, the second statement is somewhat... Oh, he's left. Unfortunately, he had to go early. I mean, you know, what's the point in giving a talk when you get to denounce someone and he leaves? This was related to Yum Tong's suggestion yesterday about the relation between Frobenius and curvature and positive characteristic. Is that, again, at bad primes, K of F, again, modulo F of P, so let's write it like that, is big. Yeah? So in fact, these bundles, which in characteristic zero, for example, are not pseudo-effective, do actually become pseudo-effective in positive characteristic, but not in a way which is in any way controllable. I mean, if you want to find sections, evidently, you have to kind of take p-th powers before you find sections and so forth. So, And then, the final thing to observe is that there's a certain degree of logical optimality in the in lemma 3, because you see, you could try to take all of these curves. So you've got many rational curves in positive characteristic, and you could try to define some analog of d mu by kind of an appropriately smart aleck cohomology theory. So if you kind of do it by an appropriately smart aleck cohomology theory, you can kind of arrive, say, I've got big rational curves for many p, maybe taking p going to infinity, and we maybe normalize them in some appropriate way. And if we are sufficiently clever about it, we can actually arrive to define a class in something like x1 iz omega x over f, which if you want to know what this actually means, this is kind of the kind of what should actually be the cohomology group for invariant measures. So here I actually had an invariant measure and it satisfies this property here. So here I have many rational curves, and I want to ask myself, where does the proof break down? Well, so far it's almost not broke down, because I may not have defined an invariant measure, but I did actually define something in the cohomology classes of invariant measures. But it's not good enough. The nevertheless, lemma 3 is still false, as it has to be. Nevertheless, there doesn't exist a closed positive representative for this class. Closed, not negative representative. So, therefore, we don't actually kind of prove that there is a contradiction in all of mathematics. So, yeah, so I think, so I think that was largely the intention of the talk, was try to bring to people's attention that, you know, if you're actually trying to prove any of these theorems, you actually have to go through certain hoops. And if you come to me with a proof and said, you know, I did it by jet spaces and controlling the base locus, I will say to you, oh yeah? So I think we've maybe finished a bit early, but I think I've said what I wanted to say, and we'll stop there. Contradictory to what? Well, no, I mean, what? My question is in A. You know, you take the entire method of proof and you try to use it to prove A, and you almost actually, or you try to prove not A, because not A would be a kind of contradiction with the rest of mathematics. So you try to prove not A, and you get very close to proving not A, and the only thing that actually stops you proving not A is you construct a cohomology class with all the right properties, but it doesn't, even though it's somehow a limit of positive cycles, it doesn't actually have a closed positive representative in characteristic zero. And a good point about A that I actually forgot was that these rational curves are the locus of supersingular of certain abelian surfaces, because these bidisk quotients parameterize abelian surfaces with real multiplication. They're the locus where the reduction is supersingular, where the real multiplication becomes supersingular. So, because Carlo pointed out to me the other day that it was actually a conjecture that every abelian surface has infinitely many primes of supersingular reduction, which actually means that in principle these curves aren't just Sariski dense, they're really pretty dense. So I mean, there are really a very large number of these curves.
Okay, thank you.